dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In many ways, this program may be one of the most important intelligence briefings that this program has been able to provide you over some 10 years of broadcasts. That's because the man that we're going to be speaking to for this full hour is one of the most thoughtful, astute, and courageous men I've ever had the privilege of knowing, and who has brought those marvelous skills to bear to inform us all about the nature of totalitarianism, specifically that practiced by the Soviet Union, one of the most egregious of the totalitarian regimes of all time, and what has been bequeathed by it to Russia, for one, and China and others elsewhere around the world. His name is Vladimir Bukovsky. He has been described by the New York Times, no less, as, quote, a hero of almost legendary proportions among the Soviet dissident movement, unquote. He grew up in the Soviet Union, spent most of his young adulthood and early years in prison, labor camps, and psychiatric hospitals because he was a refusenik. He was fighting the regime, and his inspiring story, his courage, as I said, and his insights are now captured finally in an English translation of his masterwork, Judgment in Moscow, Soviet Crimes and Western Complicity. It is a book that has been a long time coming in English. It has been out for many years in other languages, including his native Russian. But it is finally with us, and it is such an important read, and the chance to talk with him about it is truly one of the great privileges of my life, and I think you'll find it to be one of yours as well. Vladimir Bukovsky, welcome back. It is so good to have you, sir.
Okay.
We had an opportunity recently to schedule an interview with you, and you were unable to make it. I know you're not feeling well, and I so much appreciate your taking the time to speak to us about Judgment in Moscow. On that occasion, we ran the original broadcast, a reprise performance, if you will. And so we've covered some of the past history of the book and why it took so long to become available in English. But we might just take a minute or two at this point to introduce what was the genesis of this book in terms of your deep dive for the very brief period when they were available into the archives of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Would you tell us a little bit about that story?
Oh, sure. In 1992, as it so happened, when the Soviet Union was not already existing, but the Communist Party, which was prohibited from functioning in Russia, sued the government in constitutional courts of Russia, arguing that prohibiting them is against the constitution. As a result, we had the hearings in the constitutional courts of Russia, to which I was invited to be an expert witness. I had the capacity of subpoena whatever documents from the archives might be necessary, and that's what I did with abundance. I also tried to copy as many of them as possible using scanning, handheld scanner, which was a novelty at the time, so not many people understood what I was doing. Anyway, as a result of all this accumulated material, I've written a book called Judgment in Moscow, which was successfully published in 8 or 9 countries. But in English language, the establishment was against publishing it. They reckoned too many important names will be compromised in the documents. And they threatened the publisher to ruin, to bankrupt him with legal suits, no matter whether he's right or wrong. So for quite a while, I couldn't find any courageous publisher to publish it, while in all other countries it was already quite successful. So finally, we've got some American enthusiasts, a small group of amateurs who had never published books before but decided to try, and they were successful. So luckily for us, the book is finally published in English.
And what it is comprised of?
It's mostly based on the secret documents of the Central Committee Archives and Politburo Archives. And it's kind of a post-mortem of the Soviet regime. I tried to establish why and how it demised and what contributed to it and so on. So it's a very bulky book consisting of so many documents.
Yes. Well, it's a resource of incomparable importance, it seems to me, about 700 pages long, all told. And what I think is as interesting as anything, and in a way it's why the suppression of the book went on for so long, I think, is the tale that you tell of the lengths to which Western politicians, business leaders, and academics and others, the lengths they went to perpetuate the Soviet Union. It might have fallen of its own weight years before had it not been for the active intervention and financial assistance of détente. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, I wasn't very much surprised by it. I already observed it. It's in a sense, philosophically speaking, in a sense, it's their dream to have a socialism on Earth. And even if they don't agree with everything the Soviet Union was doing, the direction of their development seemed to be for them as progressive, as important. And that's why they would justify any crime in it.
Yeah, they justified any crime towards the people of the Soviet Union. And it's, it was very good called it evil empire beyond. But also, you know, crimes that it was perpetrating elsewhere in the world as well. And the enabling of those crimes and the pass that they were given is an extraordinarily important story. And I want to turn, we have to take a short break, Vladimir Bukovsky, but when we come back, I want to start with specifically the era of Gorbachev, what he was doing and what he was enabled to do by his friends in the West, including some here in the United States of America. We'll be speaking much more about all of this with Vladimir Bukovsky straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are spending this hour with Vladimir Bukovsky, an extraordinarily important figure in the war for the free world. He was a dissident inside the Soviet Union. He was an inspiration once he was released in 1976 in exchange for the Chilean communist leader, Luis Corvalon. He has been writing and essentially championing freedom in the West ever since, notably through his extraordinary prison memoir, To Build a Castle, and now through his newly released English translation of Judgment in Moscow, Soviet Crimes and Western complicity. And I want to speak to you, Vladimir, at this point about Western complicity with the last gasps of the Soviet system, namely the determined effort of Mikhail Gorbachev, the general secretary of the Soviet Communist Party and its endgame, to perpetuate the regime. And the sorts of techniques that he used both within Russia and externally. Let's talk first and foremost about this phenomenon that he dubbed glasnost. What's the literal meaning of the word glasnost in the Russian tradition?
Well, glasnost as such means openness, transparency. But in Russian context, it means more than that. In history, in 19th century, in other periods, when great reforms were introduced in the life, it all started with glasnost, a period when the past mistakes and crimes were openly and publicly debated. So this happened the same with Gorbachev, except it was a deception. He had no intention of abandoning the communist system. He simply tried to salvage it, to correcting it a bit from one or another side, and continuing with it, claiming that now it is a democracy, while it was still the same regime, except in a more mild form. So that was the basic idea. The whole concept, the whole project of perestroika and glasnost was a big deception, a big KGB deception.
Now, on this point, it seems as though central to that deception was the idea that the West would be more forthcoming with aid and financial underwriting and other technology and benefits if it were persuaded that this sort of reformation was taking place. You mentioned perestroika. Define that term for us as well, and what, in fact, it meant in the Soviet context.
It was not very deep rearrangement within the system, rearrangement, trying to make the system a bit more productive than it usually was. And that's it. No changes in principle were visualized. Gorbachev would speak about democratization, but he never meant democracy. He would speak about socialist market socialism, no kind of nonsense, but he would never introduce the open and simple market economy.
Which would have required a degree of relinquishing control by the Soviet system and the Communist Party.
Leave society to self-rule, self-government, which the communists had no intention to do. So that's how it went, and as a result, since it was only half measure, it ended up in disaster. They collapsed.
Yeah. I like to think that's in part because of the residual practice of Ronald Reagan in trying to help bring down the Soviet Union. Towards the end, he became much enamored of Gorbachev, of course, but I think some of the policies that Reagan had set in train simply were not possible to reverse at that point and help bring about the end of this horrific regime. And yet, it wasn't really the end, was it, Vladimir Bukovsky? What you described powerfully in Judgment in Moscow was it was more like a Chapter 11 sort of bankruptcy reorganization. And I'd ask you to talk about specifically the role played by Vladimir Putin in all of that, as well as Boris Yeltsin, but specifically Putin because he's very much with us today, of course.
Yes, faced with the collapse and bankruptcy, the system kind of mutated. I mean, they decided to pretend to be democracy and whatever, the market, in order to salvage itself from the bankruptcies. And of course, who was to implement such a difficult plan, if not the former KGB? who at that stage still existed, although under a different name and with pretense that they are not as bad as the previous version, you know. In reality, they were exactly the same, and they were just seizing power in the country, total control, and trying to make impressions that they're different.
Now, you, of course, have a lot of experience with the KGB, having been one of the victims of its repression. You also, I think, have studied very closely the various steps that were taken to obscure its true designs and its sort of reincarnation under different acronyms. But as you look at it, Vladimir Bukovsky, what is it that would be the continuing characteristics of that security state apparatus and the preservation of the kind of control that the party had had before the fall of the Soviet Union and that now resides in Vladimir Putin and his coterie of oligarchs, I guess, primarily, and you know, sort of power ministry apparatchiks?
Well, it's what used to be called nomenklatura. This certain top layer of bureaucracy, let it be in politics, in finances, in the army, in the security, whatever. So these people didn't want to part with the power and these enormous privileges they have. So they made it in a very clever plan of resurrecting and pretending to be as any other country, while in reality they were still controlled by the old apparatus. And of course all the profits generated by whatever way they did would be shared between them and would not benefit the country. So it's a parasitic arrangement.
Yeah, very, very well said. And essentially, it was a case of stripping the state of its resources, most of which had been organized, of course, as state-owned entities, and putting them in the hands of trusted allies of Putin, did they not?
Yeah. So that's what we have at the moment, and this regime, although very unstable, still clings to power and not that easy to change it.
But that's a key observation, that it is still fundamentally an authoritarian, if not a totalitarian regime. And as you, just if you could, Vladimir, in terms of your own experience with such a system, what does that mean for the people of Russia today? Are they still effectively enslaved by Vladimir Putin? Are they still essentially following the kind of state-dominated life that you rebelled against back in the day?
The system they have right now is a very little bit more relaxed than the totalitarian system. They do have several possibilities, such as immigrating from the country. And that's what happens en masse. Millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people immigrated from Russia in the last 20 years. And this trend continues. So that is practically what differentiates the current regime from the previous one. Also, they tried for a very long time to run some small businesses and medium-sized businesses. And for a while, they managed. But, of course, the state machine would come and suffocate them all. So now it's not an issue anymore.
And there's no real evidence that any kind of political pluralism is going to be tolerated, is there? There's talk about anti-Putin parties and candidates, but they seem to be being suppressed fairly effectively by the regime.
Oh, sometimes they even killed. We have quite a systematic murder of oppositional figures of journalists looking to find the roots of the system, and so on and so forth. It's massive. It's murderous. And of course, apart from that, the chance of any outside independent figure to get into the open fight with the regime is very small.
Yeah, very small and very dangerous, needless to say. Vladimir Bukovsky is our guest for this full hour, extraordinarily important conversation. And when we return after a short break, we're going to discuss with him what Putin is up to now with respect to our own country, as well as his policies more broadly around the world, and what it means for all of us. That and much more with Vladimir Bukovsky, the author of Judgment in Moscow, Soviet Crimes and Western Complicity. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Vladimir Bukovsky is with us, thanks be to God, for a very, very important conversation about the nature of Soviet communism and what has evolved from it under Vladimir Putin, most especially what it means for the people of Russia, but what it means for the rest of us, in particular those of us in this country. Vladimir Bukovsky has been working on writing about warning of the nature of totalitarianism, specifically as it's been practiced under the various leaders of the Kremlin. But we have been privileged to catch him to talk about both the history of the Soviet era, in which he played an important role in helping it come to an end, and what, as I say, is going on at the moment and what may be coming next. These are the topics that he has addressed brilliantly and with copious detail, including documents taken from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union's archives that were influential in some of the end of the Soviet period, but also very important to our understanding of what's afoot now. So, Vladimir, again, welcome. It's so good to have you. Let's talk a little bit about what Putin has been doing lately. We've been hearing endlessly about the interference that the Russian Federation engaged in our 2016 elections. We've been hearing a lot about collusion between Donald Trump and the Putin regime. Not proven, I hasten to add, but nonetheless, we hear a lot about it. If you could, just talk to us about the nature of Putin's regime as it relates to the United States, and in particular, if you would, the likelihood that, in fact, Putin would have preferred to have a Hillary Clinton in the presidency rather than a Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, essentially, if you try to assess what exactly the Putin regime is trying to achieve right from the beginning, it's pretty obvious that he is trying to return the Soviet system without naming it. It's a kind of back to the USSR movement. He returned the red banner to the army, the old national anthem with a bit changed words. He always claims about former Soviet sphere of influence and trying to restore it, be it in the nearby former republics of the Soviet Union, as well as among the East European countries and other satellite countries of Soviet Union. He's just trying to restore the same empire, the same Soviet Union, without naming it the same way. And, of course, it doesn't work completely. I mean, part of it does work, but most of it doesn't. And as a part of that scenario, they do need a constant confrontation with the United States, which gives them the impression of being superpower and some kind of a force to be reckoned with, and, you know, is attractive of an alternative for different countries. So that's one of the things. And of course, when doing that, they would be constantly in one or another form in conflict with the law in the United States, including the election system, which they routinely tried to influence, believe me, much before Putin. It was part of the game all the time. Simply at that time, there were no computers to do it so effectively. But in the past, they also tried some ways of influencing the outcome of elections. Now, of course, for them, Hillary Clinton is ideal partner. They would be smoothly doing exactly what they both want. Trump is a bit awkward, difficult fellow to understand, somewhat unpredictable, some maverick. And yet, it couldn't be as smooth with him as it could be with Hillary, you know, precisely because he is some kind of maverick. So it wasn't a good result for them to have him elected.
Well, this is so fascinating because I think what you've said makes eminent sense, that Hillary was a known commodity. Not only that, but arguably she was deeply compromised by, among other things, the Uranium One deal and this program of technology transfer to Russia under the rubric of this Skolkovo sort of Silicon Valley for Russia. And this would have been a woman that they would have, I think, seen it possible to have their way with, shall we say. Which makes the whole question of the intervention of Russia on Trump's behalf, I think, even more preposterous. But let me ask you this, Vladimir, because as you've looked at what Putin is doing at the moment, as you say, he needs the United States to be an adversary to promote his own stature and that of Russia as a superpower and to justify the enormous expenses that he's, you know, investing in nuclear weaponry and the like. To the extent that that is so, is it really a fool's errand to think that we can have normal relations with Putin, that our mutual interests in some places around the world and the threat that I think, frankly, is posed to both countries by Sharia supremacists on the one hand and communist China on the other might create a basis for collaboration? Is that a possibility or not so much?
No, I don't think there is any chance of United States and Russia finding common policies and cooperation. I don't think so. No, the Putin regime needs you some kind of a big threat to humanity, which they are protecting humanity from. Now, it's a bit general, but if you look at what they're doing, they're carefully trying to restore their sphere of influence. Look at what they're doing in Ukraine. They're trying to recapture Ukraine and deprive it of its independence slowly by provocations, by some kind of aggressive policies in some parts of it. Confiscating the whole Crimea, by the way, and so on and so forth. And of course, they hope they would slowly achieve the return to the complete control of Ukraine. But they know they can't do it quickly. At the moment, what they're doing is not terribly successful. They're stuck. In the first initial stages, they seem to be successful, but then they're stuck. And now, with the opposition of the entire world, there's very small chance they would be successful.
In taking over Ukraine or making broader inroads in the so-called near abroad beyond.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good thing, if so, needless to say. Stuck is where we want them to be. But I am intrigued, and I want to talk with you in greater detail here in a moment about lessons from the Soviet and Russian eras for our relationship with the next horrific totalitarian communist regime that clearly threatens us, and that is communist China. But But before we go there, Vladimir Bukovsky, when you look at Putin and the ambitions that he has, do you anticipate that the sorts of threats that he has periodically made to, say, the Baltic states, for example, or to, for that matter, some in Eastern and even Central Europe, may be something that he would be as prepared to act upon as he was Crimea at a point? Or do you think that having gotten stuck in Ukraine, he may not feel that he's got the latitude to act further aggressively?
Well, I wouldn't rule out a chance of him trying. He might try something stupid with Baltic countries and with some other areas. Although I'm pretty sure he would fail. His attempts are not going to be successful. It's already obvious. He lost the moment. It could have been more successful in the earlier stages. Now it doesn't promise anything.
When you look at his policy towards China, and we'll talk about this again a bit more on the other side of a short break momentarily, but he seems to me, Vladimir, to be adopting a kind of après moi le déluge kind of attitude towards the Chinese, that he is throwing in with them strategically, he is selling them advanced weapons and sharing technology, he is enabling them to exploit the resources of Siberia, and in so many ways, it seems setting the stage for a much more ominous problem for his successors from the Chinese quarter. Do you see it that way? And if so, very quickly, what do you think might be his calculation?
Well, I think his policy is a bit one-sided. He does try to become partner with the China, but China doesn't need him as a partner. And they might use some of his offering, some of his possibilities in land and trade and whatever, but they, by and large, they ignore him.
They consider him a vassal state like they do most of the rest of the world, evidently. Vladimir Bukovsky, we have to take a last short break. We'll be right back with more with the author of Judgment in Moscow, Soviet Crimes and Western Complicity, and we'll drill down on lessons that should be learned from mistakes we've made vis-a-vis the Kremlin, now being made vis-a-vis, well, communist China, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We are in the concluding segment now of the very interesting, very thoughtful, very informative conversation with one of our time's really outsized figures. His name is Vladimir Bukovsky. He was a dissident at a very young age in the Soviet Union, and I think contributed materially, ultimately, to its downfall. He has been writing and analyzing and helping the rest of us think about the successor to that state and others that are trying to emulate its global ambitions, notably the People's Republic of China under Xi Jinping. And Vladimir, I wanted to just explore with you, if you could, some of the most important insights from the era of détente, which you document through these various materials that you were able to extract from the Communist Party archives in Moscow, that speak to the proclivity of Western companies and banks and financiers and governments, for that matter, to try to prop up, to appease and otherwise endear themselves to these totalitarians and lessons that should be learned, because we certainly seem to be doing that, if anything, in an even bigger way vis-a-vis the danger we face today from China.
Well, it's my hope that people will draw certain conclusions from the previous stages of struggle with communism. I mean, it took decades before the world found a certain answer to the communism in Ronald Reagan policy, which was effective. And before that, they tried everything else, which was not effective. So why don't we go straight to what we already achieved, found as the right strategy?
Namely, that of Ronald Reagan, I take it. And just characterize that for us, because again, you were watching it with the insight of someone who had been, you know, at the core of the opposition to the Soviet regime. How did you see the Reagan strategy, and what specifically did you think was most effective about it?
Well, first, it was open admittance of the fact that we are in confrontation, and there is no way we can kind of satisfy each other or find common grounds. It's confrontation. One of these regimes is supposed to disappear in the ash heaps of history, as Ronald Reagan put it. And he insisted that communism is one of the systems which is going to end up on these ash heaps of history. And he proved himself right.
Yeah, but you knew very well that that was the view of the Soviets also, that they were going to put us on the ash heap of history. They were about ultimate achievement of their global ambitions, no? And that is very much the view, it seems, of the Communist Party of China at the moment.
Well, the most important lesson to draw from Ronald Reagan time and the confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States is that we stopped looking for compromises, right? And once we decided that there is no possible and working compromise in our relations, we start gaining. The victory after victory followed. So as uncompromising our policy is going to be, so much the better.
This is such an important insight. And one of the pieces that was very much part of that refusal to compromise, of course, was challenging the legitimacy of the regime in Moscow. As I said earlier, the evil empire is how he characterized it. Describe for us both what it meant to the dissidents of the Soviet Union, like yourself, as well as what it meant to, you know, the fight to ultimately bring down that regime, that we had that kind of clarity, the moral clarity about the nature of it, the evil nature of it specifically.
It was a huge moral support, but it turned out to be sufficient. We hardly expected or needed anything more than that. A moral support was quite enough. And provided that the other side is not going to try compromises, to help, to salvage the Soviet system from bankruptcies, and so on and so forth. So provided that doesn't happen, the moral confrontation was enough.
Yeah. Alas, after Reagan left office, George H.W. Bush became president and pursued a rather different policy that contributed, I think it's fair to say, based on your research, to the failure to have the kind of purging of the system of the Soviet communist elements. We've talked about how they reorganized. We talked about how they found new leadership under Vladimir Putin. But especially as we're looking at China today, Vladimir, how important is it that we not only be clear-eyed about the nature of the regime? And by the way, we've had a very interesting teachable moment on that score here just in the past few days, as you probably are aware, with respect to the National Basketball Association, which is now cravenly groveling, kowtowing, I guess is the technical term for it, to the Masters of the Forbidden City. This is the kind of unlearned lesson, it seems to me, that we need to recover from. But your thoughts on that particular point, Vladimir, the importance of actually both understanding what is the source of the threat, namely this totalitarian ideology, and insisting not only that it be put out of business, but that it be torn out by the roots.
Yeah. Also, constantly uncover the nature. They would pretend, as they do now, that they're not a communist country anymore. Well, at least not in economic sense. There are certain models of economy which are different. It's total rubbish. They don't have any other models. It's the same model. So you have to uncover that deception often, systematically.
This is so critical, and again, to some extent, where we have had as a fruit of the engagement, or détente in the old days, of our academic institutions and our culture and our business leaders, and indeed many in our intelligence and defense and other government circles, all having been deceived or willfully blind to the reality of this threat, it makes vastly more difficult, doesn't it, uncovering it and countering it effectively, including, as I say, ensuring that there is this kind of delustration that is required to exercise from the community in question, whether it's Russia in the past, Soviet past, or China today, the toxic nature of the communist system.
Right. Well, I hope you're going to be successful in doing that. The more you are straightforward, then the more successful you are.
Amen. And one of the things that may give you some heart is we have helped to reestablish something called the Committee on the Present Danger, specifically for the purpose of focusing on China, but to be informed by the experience of that group, which, as you may remember, Vladimir Bukovsky was at Reagan's right hand as he was thinking through the strategy that would be needed to deal with the Soviet Union and to take it down, and that ultimately helped him actually execute that strategy with very considerable effect. At least up to a point, and that point is the one where we find ourselves, I think, now, perhaps with Donald Trump in China, where we are reckoning with this adversary in a much more clear-eyed way. But do we have the will? Do we have the wherewithal, moral as well as financial and political, to really contest this regime in China and hopefully bring about its end, but in a much more comprehensive and thorough way than we did the Soviet Union? Vladimir Bukovsky, alas, we are out of time. I am so grateful for yours today, for the heroic efforts you have made to bring these important insights to all of us. God bless you, sir. I hope you will be well and come back to us in the future. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.